Good afternoon. So last week we finished up, started by finishing up covering the FAT file system, which is the current homework. We talked about, how files and directories were stored, how we would actually create new files and directories, for which we need a way to identify where we could put clusters. And we learned that we also used the file allocation table for that. We just used a different value that wasn't ever used to indicate a next cluster. Just zero, because that's where the header was, so you wouldn't put actual file data there. Then we talked about how hard drives work physically. We learned that the biggest intuition we got is that we want to put data close to related data on the hard drive to avoid these physical costs of actually moving a physical disk head and waiting for the disk to rotate in order to read data. Now, if, for example, we want different parts of a file to all be near each other on the disk physically. And then we talked about solid-state disks. And solid-state disks imitate this hard disk interface, but they need to scatter data all over the place because, the technology they work with doesn't work the same way as hard drives. In particular, it has these erasure blocks where it has to manage it so it spreads the data out among the erasure blocks, which was called wear leavening, and it only erases this whole large block, which is much bigger than what the OS treating the solid-state disk like a hard drive is going to write or read at a time. Then we talked about a different file system design, the classic Unix-like file system design, which, because it's Unix, is what XV6 does. And these have inodes. So all the file data is in this inode. So there's information about where the file's data is, about any metadata, like who owns it, what type of file is it a directory, and so on, which we saw, was somewhat in the directory entries on FAT. But this is along with the information about where is the file stored. We had this array of block pointers to indicate where the file was stored rather than having that linked list like the file allocation table mechanism did. And we still need to deal with larger files. And we saw when we were finishing up last time that the way we dealt with these larger files is we had an array of pointers to blocks. And if the file was small, that was enough. And otherwise, we had these indirect pointers. So we had a pointer to more array of block pointers. And if that wasn't enough, we had a pointer to pointers to pointers. And if that still wasn't enough, we had a pointer to pointers to pointers to pointers, which gave us this picture. So, any questions about anything we talked about last time before I move on? Yeah?
For a structure like this, let's say it's a triple inode file system, mm-hmm. Are the last three always pointers to indirect blocks?
So the question is, in a file system like this, does this always have to be a triple indirect? What if we only have one extra block left over? And typically the way these file systems have been implemented is they've decided, yes, we're always going to do that. You could imagine, it might make sense, if you felt that just going slightly over was common, that you might want not to do that. But in these designs, they typically want to make it so all the accesses to figure out a block work the same way no matter the size of the file. If you know the offset, you use the same exact procedure to figure out where that block is, no matter what file it is. Yeah?
Could you go over the process on doing problems like question 4 on the quiz or the example that we did at the end of last class? So
this example.
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So let's go through this example. And we said we had 1K blocks and 4-byte block pointers. So first one thing we want to figure out is that, first thing we can figure out is that we have these 12 direct block pointers. And these are direct, and that means in the inode. So we know that we have an inode. We don't need to allocate space for that inode as a block. It's part of this inode array, which is statically set aside. So we're not going to count that as a block allocated to this file. It's an inode allocated to the file, but we have to use that space for inodes. We can't use it for data sometimes. So we have 12 times 1k. So that's 12 kilobytes of data. And that's using our direct pointers. So then we need to think about our indirect pointers. So this is our inode, and we have 1, 2, 3, 12 to the data. And we have an indirect pointer where we have one pointer to a block of pointers. So one block of pointers is 1k bytes divided by 4 bytes per pointer. And if we do this division, do our dimensional analysis, we figure out that this is the number of pointers, and we get 256. You do that in your head, that's fine. You can take 1024 long division by 256 if you need to, or by 4 rather. So you get 256 pointers. So here we're going to have 256 pointers located at block number in inode. So this gives us 256k of data, and we have 1k of overhead. We allocated 1k to store those pointers, because that's the amount of space 256 pointers take up. So then we have our double indirect. So here we have 256 pointers to 1k of pointers. So we have 1k for these pointers, and then we have 256k for the next layer of pointers. So this is our overhead, so that we have 257k of data overhead. That's data just holding pointers. We have 1k holding the indirect pointers, and 256k holding these extra direct pointers. And on this picture here, that's saying that we can count here, we have 1k here. Each of these boxes is 1k. So here we have 1k for our double indirect block, and then we have 256k for everything it points to. And this is marked in green here, is all stuff that doesn't actually store our file's data, just pointers to blocks. Overhead, and ultimately we have 256 squared k of data being pointed to by that last level. And for our triple indirect, we have 1k plus 256k, because if we go from the beginning, we have the same organization. We have 1k here that points to 256k here, and each of these has 256 pointers to 256 things. So each one of these points to, again, 256k. So we have 256 times 256 at that next level. Yeah. And 256 cubed k of data pointed to. Yeah. So this is how much space for pointers. So we have 1k of pointers, which is 256 pointers. And here we have 256k of pointers, which is 256 times 256 per kilobyte pointers. Does that make sense? And obviously the numbers would be different. If we had 2K blocks, we'd say we'd still have 1K of 256 pointers per kilobyte, but the pointers would point to more stuff. They point to 512K of pointers. So the numbers would work out differently. 512 pointers. So other questions here? Yeah. Do we ever run out of data blocks? There's a finite number of data blocks on the disk, so possibly. We can also run out of space. There's also a file size limit here based on just the number of things we can possibly point to with this structure, where you might say, oh, I want to quadruple in direct pointer to store more data, and, well, you don't have one. And I believe if you actually do this math, you find out that with this extended 2 scheme, that this is actually embarrassingly small. It's like a single-digit-ish number of gigabytes. And you might say, well, I've never ran into problems storing really huge files, and probably the reason why is that this 1K blocks number is unreasonably small for a very large, for a multi-terabyte disk. It's probably more like 4 kilobytes. And if you have 4 kilobytes, everything here gets much bigger. But it's still a limitation. We'll talk about some alternate ways of storing file locations, which are both not as sort of inefficient as the file allocation tables and are more flexible than this. But that's later on. Okay. So any more questions on these indirect blocks? Counting. That's indirect blocks. So indirect blocks are actually a very nice scheme for storing file information. So one thing that's nice is that small files, which turns out is most files, we'll talk about that more later, it's all direct blocks, so we just allocate them in inode and we're done. We don't need to allocate them any more space. And that's going to be the common case. So commonly, we won't be allocating these overhead blocks. It's only for very large files that we'll need to do that, for larger files, where we pay for the extra indirection. This is not like FAT, where even a twice as big file incurs like twice as much indirection for finding its blocks here. The very small files like have no cost, and then as files get bigger and bigger, we have more cost. And the amount of indirection, if you're thinking of, I'm going to go to a random place in the middle of this file and look up data, it's order log n to look that up. Because we look up the number of layers we have grows sort of, you know, like a tree, so it's log n type growth as far as how many places we have to look to find the block number we were looking for like a particular index into the file. And this isn't like FAT, where it grows linearly as the file gets bigger. But as I said, we'll talk about a more flexible scheme later on, because you have one complaint, which is for larger files, this is sure a lot of data that's storing nothing. And it sure seems to make doing something like, let's read a gigabyte into memory, awfully complicated. Because we need to read a whole lot of block numbers and send them all to the disk to get it to read the right things, or like figure out that they're all contiguous and send the ranges to the disk. That's a lot of work. So something that this scheme allows that most Unix-like file systems do that you might consider kind of weird is something called sparse files. So we mentioned that, you know, if we don't have a big file, we aren't going to use like these indirect pointers at the end. Turns out you cannot use pointers anywhere in the middle of the file too. So we can have a file here where I open a file, seek a megabyte into the file, and write some data. The way most Unix-like file systems will store this is that they'll only store the block a megabyte into the file. They won't store any other blocks. They'll just have block pointers that are null. And, you know, this is supported arbitrarily. So we can think of, like, for extended two, we might have, you know, some file which has data, you know, about half a kilobyte in, and a little later, so they'll have some block pointer set, everything else will be set to null, and we store this file that way. We don't store these big empty regions, where empty in this case means it's going to be all zeros. And if the program ever tries to read from, say, block zero, we'll just say, oh, there's no data for that. I'm just going to mem set a page of zeros for you. There you go. That's the dot file. Okay, so questions about sparse files? So this is an arguably useful feature. Arguably not really useful, but it's something that is sort of a natural consequence of this block pointer-based scheme that is really easy to do in that scheme. So other things, I mentioned earlier we had hard links. So the directory entries, because we have inodes, just contain a name and an inode number. And I told you we call this a hard link. Because all the non-name information is in the inode itself. So all the directory contains is a pointer to the inode. And the inode contains the file size, the file type, the owner, modification times, everything that was like kind of stuffed in the directory entry in FAT is now in this inode. And this means a file, actually, on these file systems can have multiple hard links. And it's really the same file. So on Unix, you can do this with the ln for link command. So I can create a file. I can make a new hard link to it, in this case called new.txt. Now test.txt and new.txt are the same file. There are two directory entries with the same inode number. And that means if I overwrite new.txt, it changes text.txt because I'm changing the same file. And when we're looking up that file, we don't look in the directory to find out its data. We look in its inode. We go to the same inode. Works the same way. So a tricky thing about this is, what if I remove test.txt? Well, to make this work, I need to not remove it until all the hard links have gone away. So these Unix-like file systems actually track the number of links to an inode. And when that goes to zero, they actually remove it. And they also do a little trick in this, is at runtime, they count open files as a link to that file. And this allows us to not break programs which open a file and then that file is deleted while they have it open. So in fact, on one of these Unix-like file systems, they won't really delete the file until you close it by tracking it like a hard link, that your open file descriptor. And this is also on Unix-like, a trick you might see real programs doing to create a temporary file. Is that they'll open a file, create it, unlink it, and then they have a file descriptor to a file with no name. And because it has no name, it's going to go away when that last file descriptor that has it open goes away. So it's a good, it's a nice way to create a temporary file. Okay. So that's link. So you might say, so I show you the commands for this. The ln command is equivalent to the POSIX link call. And the POSIX call for removing a file, because of this, is called unlink. So some of you may, who here has ever used the ln command? And you probably, who has ever used the ln command without an option that starts with a dash? So no one. So most people use ln command for something which isn't as weird as this. They use it for something called symbolic links, also known as soft links. So as you might guess from the name, these work differently than hard links, and they're kind of less of a serious link to the file. So here, I create a file test.txt, and I use ln-s to create a soft link to the file. And it's not the same as the file. When I use ls to look at it, I see that it's telling me new.txt points to test.txt. So it's not the same file. It's not like a duplicated directory entry. Instead, what we've created is basically we created a directory entry which contains the name of another file. So the directory entry effectively is something like new.txt. Instead of having an inode number, it says c test.txt. And the directory entry for test.txt has an inode number in it. And when the OS sees in the symbolic link, when you try to open a file, it looks at that C entry, resolves it like it was opening a file from that location. So that means, for example, here when I remove the file it points to, the link's still there, and if I try to use it, the OS set tries to open new.txt and it goes away, doesn't work. So another notable thing is that this string here, this could go to, you know, could refer to other directories. Like it could be dot dot something, for example, meaning to go to the parent directory. That's symbolic links. So symbolic links are just these, just names of other things that aren't maintained the same way. They aren't an actual item number. They aren't like a normal directory entry. Okay. Okay, so questions about hard and soft links? Okay. So we looked at the XV6 file system and sort of variations on it, like extended 2, which is basically the production-ish version of that. And it has a bunch of things that are better than FAT. So one thing is that there was this big region labeled a log. That's support for reliability. We'll talk about that later, probably Thursday. Some other things. So it had this free block map. That's possibly easier to scan for free blocks because it doesn't have the free block information mixed with the next cluster number information. It's all just free blocks. It's easier to find the kth block of a file because we know to look in a particular array. We don't have to traverse a linked list. And we've held the file size information in one place. Now, the XV6 file system still has some issues with respect to performance. And we're going to talk about making more performant file systems since we just talked about like how hard disks work. And we can see that XV6 file system and the FAT file system are doing things which aren't great. So one thing is the inode data on a big disk is going to end up being stored far away from the file data. It's always stored at the beginning of the disk. The file data, as our disk gets used, gets stored closer and closer to the end of the disk. So we have to read stuff near the beginning of the disk and stuff near the end of the disk in order to read a file. Also, when we allocate files, XV6 just finds the first free block, puts the file there. And this means that we're likely to have files which are like in lots of little pieces. Because we free a few files near the beginning of the disk, then we write a big file. Now that big file has a few pieces near the beginning of the disk, and the rest is near the end where there is free space. It's not great. So we'd like to avoid that. Another thing is that block size is a very tricky thing. So XV6 chooses a fixed block size, and all the block sizes we choose, you're going to be kind of unsatisfied with. So in the case of XV6, the block size they choose is 512 bytes. That's pretty small. And that means if we want to store multi-megabyte files, well, we need to store information about every single block of those 512 byte blocks. And you could say, okay, well, we can just make a simple change, just change that pound define for the block size to a bigger number. And we could do that. Then you'd probably say, gosh, I only wanted to store this half kilobyte text file. Why is it taking up this 4 kilobyte or 8 kilobyte block? So either way, we're kind of disappointed. Either we're storing a huge amount of information for big files, or we're storing a lot of wasted space for small files. So another thing that is still bad is that we don't have to linearly search to find a particular block of a file, but to find the file in a directory, we need to scan each directory all the way through, because it's just a list of name and item numbers. There's nothing to help us actually figure out, where to look in that directory. We just have to scan the whole thing. If we have a directory with 10,000 files, we need to scan through all those 10,000 files to see, is it foo.txt? Is it foo.txt? We're looking for foo.txt. So we're going to talk about solutions to all of these problems, or at least partial solutions. I'm going to first talk about a bunch of solutions that were in a very early Unix file system called the Berkeley Fast file system. And this is the file system that Linux has extended to is based on. It's basically like what Unix file systems were designed around for a long time. And then I'll talk about some newer things that are beyond the fast file system, which is handling large files and avoiding those linear directory searches. So the fast file systems, you're not going to be happy with how it handles very large files. It's not going to actually fix anything there. But it'll deal with small files better. And it's not going to fix linear directory searches. We'll do that later. So let's talk about some of these issues and how we might fix them. So one issue here is that we're storing the file data far away from its actual data blocks. And this is just because we have the inodes are all at the beginning of the disk. They're all together. So our fix for that is going to be, well, let's split up the inodes into pieces and try to keep those pieces with the data blocks. And there's a technique for this known as block groups. And basically what you can think of this as is that we sort of divide the disk into these mini file systems, which all have the same sort of layout we have. We have a free map for that part of the disk, an inode array for things which are hopefully stored in that part of the disk, and the data for things in that part of the disk. And the idea is that every file is going to be part of one of these block groups, and hopefully it has its inode here and its data here, so we don't have to seek very far to get between the two. And the way we'll typically do this is we'll split our inodes across inodes and block numbers across this. That will say we'll assign some set of block and numbers and inodes to each set part of the disk. And this means that in the cases where, say, we run out of space in this data for block group one, the inodes here can still have pointers to these blocks. We're just going to try to avoid that. So in the worst case, yes, a file's data could be in the wrong block group. But typically, we're going to keep it in the right block group. But having that worst case available means that we don't have to worry about running out of space in each block group. And if that happens, we can go to another one. Yeah, it's slower, but at least we're storing the data and it still works. Now, we need to assign files to these block groups. So to do that, we're going to try to keep files that are related together. And we're also going to try to keep data that's related to the file together. And the heuristic that FFS chose for this is that they're going to try to keep each directory and its files in one block group. So this means that the directory entry for the file and the inode for the file and the data for the file will typically all be in one place. Subdirectories might go to a different block group, but within a directory, we hopefully stay within one block group. And this is how we spread out our files across the block groups and not just like occupy the first one and then run out of space. And this hopefully means that when we're scanning through a directory, we have much lower seek times, that we happen to just go to one part of the disk for everything in that directory, like where I'm compiling something or something like that. All my C files happen to be together on the disk just naturally with this scheme. So, questions so far? Yeah.
How does a directory get assigned to a block group?
The question is, how does a directory get assigned to a block group? So I don't remember the exact scheme, but I believe it's basically when you create a directory, the heuristic is you typically put it in a new block group that's different than its parent directory. Okay, other questions? So this means that for files which fit in the block group and directories that fit in the block group will stay within the block group, and for large files, we'll do something where we'll just have the data end up being split up across block groups. And yeah, that's going to make it so the large file is divided into pieces, but hopefully these pieces are pretty big, like here. Like you see, we have, yeah, this is going to involve a bunch of seeking, but we'll have a big chunk we read, then we seek, then read another big chunk, then we seek and read another big chunk. And that's hopefully how we can make things work out when we have these big files that don't fit within one block group. So a concern you might have, though, is like, what about the smaller files? Are they going to actually be like one contiguous thing in the block group? And the FAST file system, what they did is they just said, we're going to still do a really simple allocation policy. And we're just going to allocate the first three blocks. And the intuition for this is that for small files, well, you don't really care. So for small files, we'll have these little holes that were made by freeing little files. But for big files, they'll use space at the end of the block group typically, and they'll end up being mostly contiguous. So that's their hope here, is that a large file, we end up needing more free space that's not in the holes that are already there, so typically ends up contiguous. It's not guaranteed, obviously. You could delete files in a way which makes this not happen. But the hope is, as long as we have free space at the end of block groups, we'll do this. Yeah?
So does the first write to the end of the list and work its way back?
So the question is, where do we write first? So the policy here is that we write to the first free block always first,
even
for a large file. And the hope is that for a large file, yeah, so we're going to have some like scattered chunks at the beginning of the file, but the most of the file is going to end up being contiguous just the way this naturally works out. Because we'll get to that big free region near the end, which we never get to unless the block group fills up. And to make this work, something that the FAST file system did, which at the time was maybe a little less obvious, is they said, we're never going to fill our disk. That we're going to assume that we're going to have at least 10% of our space free. Because that makes this sort of scheme work well. Yeah. The question, if there were more of the small holes, would it skip the small holes? No. So this is an assumption that typically we won't have that many of the small holes, or if we do, they'll happen to cluster together, so they'll effectively be like we had a large hole. But it's not guaranteed.
So what's the difference between this and then...
So the reason why this might work better than what XV6 is doing. So first of all, I guess there's two things. So one thing is this tells you what XV6 is doing is maybe not so bad. The other thing is that this is only within a block group. So hopefully directories with large files won't interfere with each other. And there was a policy that I didn't mention explicitly, is that they're going to try to keep free space deliberately. So they're going to say that if you take that, we're going to not use all the space in the disk, which means a typical block group for a new directory is going to have a whole bunch of extra space at the end. So if we write a very large file there, it's going to end up using a contiguous set of space there, most likely. So that was the intuition that why they thought this heuristic would work. But you're right, it's not guaranteed. And in particular, if we almost fill up the disk, it's definitely not going to happen. We're going to only have little holes. We're only going to have large holes if there's a lot of free space on the disk. Yeah?
In practice, how does the file system actually keep the disk deliberately underutilized?
The question is, how does it keep the disk deliberately underutilized? So the typical mechanism they used for this is when you formatted the disk, they just said the disk capacity is 90% of the blocks we have free. Is like the policy they would use. And if you have, like, with modern disk sizes, for most people, this is actually pretty reasonable. Like, you're not, you don't want to fill up your 4 terabyte disk over 90%, probably. Yeah?
Is it 10% of each block group, or 10% of the total?
FFS chose 10% of the total. So this is across the whole disk. So yes, some block groups would be more utilized and some would be less. Part of the something which sort of compensated for this is when it assigned directories to block groups, it might take into account how much was used in each block group. So a new directory would be assigned to different block to a relatively empty block group. And there might be details I'm not mentioning for how you deal with a full block group in real implementations of this. Okay, so that's stars. Yeah, and so the way it used block groups, so the idea is all the files in a directory are in a block group, subdirectories go to a new block group, where we just choose an IDO number in a good block group to use that's different, on the assumption it's going to have files that are accessed not together with its parent directory, which might not be true. And we take the first free blocks with the hope that we'll get these contiguous runs because we have free space naturally. Also, it's worth noting that part of the reason why we thought we'd get these runs of free space is that they waited until after, you know, the file was written and they had to evict it from the cache to write it to disk. So this meant that if you wrote a file, a multi-megabyte file, over, you know, several seconds, it's not going to write it as you're doing that. It's going to have it in the cache first, and then it's going to allocate blocks for it all at once. And this makes it much more likely that the file will be contiguous, because we're not interleaving that with other things which are also writing files. So any questions about block groups? So block groups help deal with these first two problems, that now we're keeping the file data close to its directory entries and its inode. So that's a lot better. And it means that we're less bad as far as allocating file space contiguously, in that we often get contiguous file space, even with a very simple policy of find first, you know, first thing in the block group, because the block groups tend to have these empty space at the end, provided we keep that space empty. So next issue we're going to talk about is wasting space for small files. And this is perhaps more of a concern than it seems like. You know, it's not just a concern if you want to make that block size really big. Even if that block size is relatively modest, small files are a lot of your files. So people have looked at how people use file systems. So someone looked at a bunch of different workloads at academic institutions and web servers and companies, and looked at the distribution of file sizes. And here we have a log scale of the file sizes. And here we have a CDF. So this dot here means that over 90% of files were 10 kilobytes or less in the web workload. And we can see that if we look at this 1 kilobyte mark, It depends on the workload, depends on what type of files you have. But quite often, like more than half the files are less than a kilobyte. This was in 2000, maybe sizes have changed, but this is typically the sort of things people have seen, that a lot of the files are really small. So it's actually very, very important how you handle these really small files. And arguably, maybe way more important than how you handle these multi-megabyte files, though of course, reading those takes more time per file. So that's a reason to care about those. So most files are small. So given that, we want some way of dealing with the small files better. And these are files which are going to be less than a block. If our block size is 1 kilobyte, well, most files are smaller, a lot of files are smaller than that, and some many workloads, most of them. And if we want to have our block size be something bigger to store less block pointers, well, then we're going to really hurt all these small files. We want to make it 4 kilobytes. Now we're learning that, you know, 50% of our files were wasting 3/4 of the data block we assigned to them. That's a lot of space. So the fast file systems approach for this is they divided each block into fragments. And typically, for large files, we don't allocate fragments, but they said that the last block of a file could be a fragment. So we'll allocate less than a block, but only for the last block of a file. And we just have this extra field in our inode indicating, yes, the last block is a fragment number, not a block number, or no, it isn't. And in our free map, we need to store the whether each fragment is free. So complication is that the free map is free fragments. But the idea is you find a fragment, you take these fragments of a block, and you store now 4 small files in them. And that will make these small files use a lot less space. And that's worth the extra overhead of storing more information to track what parts of my blocks are free, because I've divided a lot of them into these fragment sub-pieces. And presumably when allocating these fragments, you'll try to allocate a fragment that is one that where other parts of that block are used by a file first. Yeah?
Where do you store the metadata for the small files? Is it in that extra inode field?
So where do you store the metadata?
Yeah,
so the small file still has an inode. Okay. And basically the way you can think of this, so one way you could think of this is that this extra field would just be that we'd have the block pointer be a different type of like a negative number or something, would be a way you could imagine doing it. I think typically file systems have like had an extra bit in the type information for it, would be a common way of doing it. But it's still a normal inode. So other questions? Yeah.
Is this all for making seek times faster?
So the question is this for making seek times faster? Not particularly. So this probably doesn't really help our seek times. It might help seek times a little bit in that we're wasting less space, therefore we can store more stuff closer to together. But the big gain is that we're wasting less disk space. So the question is, how are we releasing space? So to avoid storing too many block pointers, a common thing you would want to do is you want to have a block size around 4K. And that means all these files over here are using a half or a quarter of a block. So if you didn't subdivide the blocks into pieces, then you're going to end up wasting half of each of these blocks for hundreds of thousands of files. And that's going to add up. And if you made the block size smaller, which would be the other solution, then you're going to be storing a lot more block pointers for the files that are up here. And yeah, there's not many of them, but they take up a lot of your disk space, even though there's not many of them. Other questions? So this is just about that we don't, what I said earlier, that we don't have a happy choice of block size. Like, this is sort of compromising for that. Okay, so any other questions? Okay, so these are the big things that the fast file system did, that which is what I said Linux extended to file system, which previously was the de facto standard Linux file system. Now we're going to talk about some things that are sort of newer techniques, and this is to deal with our remaining two problems, and these are things that happen in NTFS, which is, well, was Microsoft's standard file system for a while. They have a successor to it, which is based on the same thing, is my understanding, and Linux is extended 4, which is obviously two version numbers after extended 2. We'll also talk about what extended 3 did, but that's a bit later, it turns out. So one thing I mentioned with the block sizes we didn't like is that large files have a lot of metadata. And by choosing a larger block size, which we're happier doing now that we can have these fragments for very small files, that's not so bad, but it's still a lot of metadata, especially if we think about like really big files. Like if I'm storing like movies, you know, those are like many gigabytes. And even with 4 kilobyte blocks, that's a lot of block pointers I need. It's a lot of space. And I really don't want to be storing all that. And also, that means that reading the file is kind of inefficient. I need to read all these block pointers to figure out where on disk to read. And really, we'd like that file to just be stored in like one contiguous chunk on the disk anyways. So there's this idea called extents, where rather than listing a whole bunch of blocks, we just say, well, hopefully, we're going to manage to store this file in one big chunk. So what I'm going to store is a list of big chunks. I'm going to store a starting disk block number and a size. And if I do really well, my starting disk block number is going to be somewhere on the disk, and my size is going to be like 10 gigabytes. I'll just do one big 10 gigabyte read for my disk. Maybe I can't do that. If I can't do that, I'm going to have a list of these, but it's still going to be better. So because hopefully it's stored in a whole bunch of big chunks and I just read each of those big chunks together, like you saw with the file being divided up among our block groups, the big file. And this is what extended 4 and NTFS both do, at least for storing sufficiently large files, is that they store it as this list of extents. Now, this is a relatively straightforward format to store files in, but there's sort of two issues that we can see here. So one issue is this means that, you know, using this effectively means I need to allocate these contiguous sets of blocks, which means I can no longer use that really simple policy of find the first free block. If I do that, I can do that, I can use extents, but I'm probably going to have a list that's going to take up more space than if it just had block pointers because I have all these little pieces, or maybe almost as much space. Another challenge is I need to be able to figure out how to seek to a particular place in a file, and now I've made that much more complicated. Now I don't have that sort of log file size time to find where's 1 gigabyte into the file, because I have this list of extents. So let's first talk about allocation. Now, we can't use the FFS strategy. So a typical thing to do is you do something much more expensive on allocation, is that you first try to make sure you know how big the file is by waiting for it to actually be written back to disk, like we did with the fast file system, allocate all the blocks together. But rather than just taking the first blocks when you're doing that, you do something more expensive, and you scan a lot of the block map, or maybe all of it, to find some sort of fit. And what NTFS did is they chose to look for the best fit. So they look for every chunk of contiguous blocks that's big enough to hold the file, and they take the one that is closest without going under. And they put the file there. And if there's none, well, you divide it into pieces. And this turns out does pretty well. There's other strategies that you can use. So it turns out worst fit is not a bad policy, which is less intuitive. But the reason it's not a bad policy is because it leaves big chunks over. So over the long term, it still works out pretty well. But some policy like this, where you scan for holes and look for, you know, the holes that fit and order them in some way. That's typically how we allocate space for these extents. Okay. So questions? Yeah.
So would this policy make allocation slower, but then actually reading the file again is faster?
Questions, would this policy make allocation slower, but reading the file faster? Yes. That's exactly what it would do. Yeah. Allocation is going to be probably a lot slower. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Have you how would you make it quicker? Would you store the current number of open blocks and their locations in some intermediary table, or do you just scan through?
So the question is are there good data structures for speeding this up? Probably. I don't actually know what NTFS does or what file systems typically do to speed this up and how much that's worth it. I know as far as the speed goes, the performance isn't as much of an issue as it seems like it might be, mainly because, the disk is only so fast, right? Writing to the disk can only happen at 200 megabytes per second. So as long as you're faster than that at allocating, you might not notice. So I mentioned, allocation was a problem. Another problem is finding a particular place in a file, which is a list of extents, which we know is going to happen if we have a big enough file and we don't have that size space left in our disk, after the disk has been used a lot. And the solution for this is that we don't just store a list, but we store, 2150 data structures. So what do you use if you want to efficiently find a place in something by an index? Heard something? An array. So I want to efficiently look up a particular index and update a list.
Like a hash map.
So that would be great if we were looking for exactly one index. Now, unfortunately, our extents are don't look like that. So what we'll store is a tree. Now we want to change the format for this, so I guess that's why it wasn't obvious. So our tree is going to be a sort of key to value, where a key is the start byte number of the file in file, and our value is the start block number plus size. So the idea is we look up a byte number in this tree, and we find out the extent that that byte number belongs to. And we want a tree because the tree is this can be a balanced search tree, and that means we can easily figure out, the node just before a particular index, which we couldn't do with a hash table. So we're going to store a search tree of some sort. Now, on disk, we could do an AVL tree. We could actually store an AVL tree or something like that that you learned in 2150. But in practice, file systems that are trying to store this sort of thing are going to store a different kind of search tree. They're going to store a non-binary search tree and probably a balanced one. We won't talk about how you balance these. But here we have a non-binary search tree. So I have a node which contains multiple values. And I have a pointer in between each of those values. So rather than a binary search tree where I have one value and two pointers, here I have n values and n plus one pointers. So it's just a generalization of the binary search tree. And I know if, let's say I'm looking for 8, I'm going to say, well, 8's between 7 and 16, so I check this pointer. If I'm looking for 20, I say 20 is greater than 16, so I check this pointer. If I'm looking for 3, I say 3 is less than 7, so I check this pointer. So to figure out which pointer to check, I need to scan this array, the array of elements in each node, which I can do with a binary search. And I do that recursively to figure out where a particular key is. So why would we want to use this type of structure over a binary search tree? What's wrong with binary search trees for our file systems? Something to do with how disks work, why we don't want to do it. So you're saying the issue is we would be seeking too much to do the lookups.
Yeah,
so with a binary search tree, we'd have these little bits of data for each node, and then we need to seek to get to the other one, and those are probably going to be far apart. So the idea of this scheme is that we're writing these big, these blocks. Yeah.
So just to clarify, the keys in this case, are they like extent numbers? And then
that's so what would the keys be? So for our extent case, the key would be the starting byte in the file. So we're going to look up a byte number and figure out what's the extent that contains that byte. So if we're looking up an extent, we'd say, let's say we were looking up the, so let's say 15, we want to find 13 because that's the thing just before it. And we could use the structure to do that. Yeah. Question is it still considered an extent if you can't store all the data continuously? Yes. By extent, we mean this notion of having a start block and a size rather than just a block number. That's the extent idea. So this is still extent. So this data structure we could use to store the extents. The idea is we look up the starting location of the extent. We find the one that's just before the byte we're looking for. And in addition to the key, we have the value, which I'm just not showing here for space. Yeah. And the reason we store these sort of fat nodes rather than binary search tree nodes is because so we do less levels. So we made our sort of search tree much fatter, so we have less things to read to look up a particular element. But we still have a tree structure. Another thing to know is that we have to read whole sectors at a time. So we really want to make sure that when we go to the disk, we get, we have to read 512 bytes. We want to get 512 bytes of stuff. And using these wide nodes lets us make each node take up a whole sector or a whole block. So we actually use our whole disk read rather than like reading 512 bytes, but we have a 32-byte binary search tree node. And now we've wasted all this time reading extra stuff we don't care about. So these sorts of search trees are a common thing you'll see in file systems and also in databases. Use the same kind of structure to store data efficiently on disks. So we don't have lots of random accesses because we limited the number of layers. And each node is a whole block on the disk, so we don't have to worry about storing little bits of data and having to read more than that because the disk requires us to read more than that and having to write more than that because that's how the disk works. And there are algorithms for keeping this balanced. I'm not going to talk about them in detail. They're kind of similar to what you saw in AVL trees in 2150. But obviously, a lot of things have changed to work with these fat nodes. So I mentioned using this to look up an extent. So we look up the key is our index into the file, and we find the extent closest to it to read the data from. We can also use this to get rid of the linear search to find a file in a directory. We can have our keys not be bytes numbers in the file, but file names. And we can search for a directory by name in this tree structure. And these are both things that more recent file systems have used to avoid these linear searches, is that we store this tree structure, so we have some seeking, but that means for a large directory or a file with lots of extents, we end up, you know, not reading that much metadata to actually find a particular index, because we don't have to do a linear search. Okay, so questions about trees? Okay. So we fixed a bunch of problems, and you can observe that we've done, now with all these fixes, we're done much better than FAT. Where FAT, if you think about how FAT divided up the data on the disk, it was real bad, actually, that we have to check the file allocation table for the directory, so we're always seeking to the beginning of the disk. The directory and the file might be stored in completely different places. We've now fixed that. We have to do this linear search to find a location in the file and to find a file in a directory. It's not at all good. Now, you might say, so this seems like FAT is really, really bad. XV6's file system is bad. And this is a lot better. So FAT in practice, well, people use it still. It's not actually so bad. And the big reason why is that we can kind of avoid some of this seeking by just caching things. So typically, an implementation of FAT will just keep the whole file allocation table in memory. That sort of solves a lot of that scattered data problem that we aren't going to seek on the disk. We're just going to read it into memory at boot. Yeah, it might take up a few megabytes, but these days, that's fine. And similarly, for the XV6 file system, we're going to have page cache, so we're going to be caching all these parts of the disk, so it's not going to be so bad, mostly. Okay. So that's on storing data on organizing data on files better. So any questions on that topic? So our next topic is going to be about reliability, where we're rather than how we organize the data on the disk, we're going to talk about storing it more reliably on the disk. But yes?
Okay, sorry to go back to this, but on the non-binary search trees, if we already know the byte number we're looking for, right? Like you said, if we're looking for byte 15, then we could find the starting one that's closest to that.
Yeah.
13 in this case. So in that case, why do we even need to do a lookup? What exactly are we trying to find?
So the thing is that you say, I'm looking for byte 15, and you start from here. So the process of finding 13 is you have to check, is 15 less than 7? No. So I don't want to use this pointer. Is 15 less than 16? Yes, so I do want to use this pointer. And then you'd say here, is 15 less than 9? No, so I don't want to use this pointer or this entry, and so on. So you still need to do the iteration.
But then what's stored at those nodes? What information do you get once you find 13?
So in the case of storing extents, we'd store, this is the key, and the value would be the actual extent.
Okay.
This is where the data is starting at this byte.
Okay.
In the case of our directories, the keys would be file names, and the values would be the directory entries. So what's the problem with hashing? So if we're thinking about extents, I want to look up 15 and find the thing that's just before it with a hash table that doesn't really work. In the case of directories, it's a more viable scheme. But it makes scanning the directory more awkward. Also, another issue with using a hash table is that rehashing on disk might not be so great compared to using a balanced tree, which kind of keeps itself at the right size all the time. But there are file systems which store, which solve this directory entry problem with a hash table. Some file systems that do use this balanced tree solution for directories will hash the directory names and use that as the key, but in the balanced tree. Other questions? Okay, so now that we know where data is stored and how data is stored, we can talk about what happens when things go wrong. And first I need to talk about what hard drives do when things go wrong. So if we interrupt writing to a hard drive, it's either going to write a whole sector or not. And the reason for this is not because that's physically what happens. Of course, physically, we can cut power to a hard drive while it's in the middle of changing the bits for a sector. But it stores a checksum for the sector. It has this error-correcting code, an error-detecting code, and that's going to be wrong if we interrupt it in the middle of a sector. So when we try to read in the middle of the write, we'll just learn that the sector got corrupted that was being written. So that's the sort of failure we're going to expect from hard drives, is that if we have some problem, that some sectors will be written, some won't, and maybe one or two is going to be in this in-between state where we get a read error, but we know the data's not there. So there's two things we're going to worry about when we talk about reliability. We're going to start with the first one here. So can we get the data? Is the data still there? Do we still have a copy? And the second issue is the file system in a convenient state, consistent state? And I'll talk more about what that can mean later, but as an example, like, we want it to be the case that if we renamed a file, that the file is in one of the, it has one name and not two. That either the rename happened or it didn't, not that the rename, that there's two copies of the file, or there's zero copies of the file. The file went away when we renamed it because something broke while we were writing one of the directory entries. And we've seen a reliability strategy already in the fast file allocation table system, that it stored multiple copies of the file allocation table, and it actually stores extra copies of the header too. And in inode-based file systems often use the same strategy for this important metadata. So they'll often store multiple copies of the super blocks, that's their file system header. And this is because that's so important to finding everything else on the disk that at least if part of the disk is lost, meaning that we were writing to that header and it failed in the middle, so we get a read error later on, we can at least recover the data using the backup copy. And this will hopefully let us recover most of the files in failure and avoid this embarrassing thing that most disk failures just mean we lose like part of one file, but some disk failures mean we lose all the entire file system. We don't know where anything is. This hopefully avoids that problem. But we can extend this strategy of having multiple copies and just say, why don't we just have multiple copies of everything? So there's a simple strategy, which is let's have two disks and just write everything to two disks. Every time we do write, we're going to write to both disks. Maybe we'll do it out of sync to make sure that if we cut power, we lose different data. Okay? And this is actually pretty good. So two disks, always write to both. And in fact, you know, even if we don't care about the reliability, we can still get some benefit out of this, it turns out, because we can read from either disk. So we can read two things at once now. So it's faster. So even if we don't care about the reliability, this is actually faster. So it's great. If you got reliability and disks are cheap, this is a good solution. But you might complain, this is, you know, disks aren't that cheap. I don't want to have, you know, buy twice as much disk to get this reliability. No, can we do better than that, but still give us the same property of we have a backup copy of whatever data there was? So there's a scheme for this, which is based on that error correcting or detecting codes we talked about earlier. And there's a particular version of this we're going to talk about for disks. And we're going to really take advantage of this model I mentioned earlier, that we either write the whole sector or we correct it. We're going to really take advantage of that. So that's going to make things a lot easier. That we're not going to have to worry about figuring out, is this data corrupted? The hard drive is going to tell us. So either we know we have the data, and it's the real data, or we don't have the data. And that's going to let us do what's known as parity. And this is called RAID 4. So RAID stands for redundant array of inexpensive disks. So the idea is we get redundancy from inexpensive disks. And you say 4, so there's a few. There's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and a couple more. We're going to just talk about a few selected schemes. And RAID 4 is the simplest that doesn't have that sort of two copies of everything inefficiency that you might dislike. So here, we're going to store, we're going to take our data, and we're going to divide it up among two disks. So I'm going to have you buy three disks, but I'm going to actually split the data across two of them. So you're going to get most of the capacity you bought. You know, it's not going to be you're getting the capacity of one disk by buying three. You're getting the capacity of two disks by buying three, but more reliability. And I'm going to store sector 0 on disk 1, sector 1 on disk 2, and then I'm going to store the XOR of the two sectors on disk 3. And then I'm going to store sector 2 on disk 1, sector 3 on disk 2, and the XOR of those two things on disk 3, and I'm going to continue this pattern for the entire disk. And I'm going to have this virtual disk with twice as many sectors as any one disk across these three disks. And the reason that this is a useful scheme is that because of how XOR works, I can compute the value of any missing piece block here. So if I don't have this parity data, I can compute it by XORing data from disk 1 and 2. If I don't have sector 1 here, sector 0 here, I can compute it by XORing A2 and AP. And if I don't have A2, I can compute it by XORing AP and A1 because of how XOR works. So this means if we lose any disk, if we lose a single sector on the disk, or we lose the entire disk breaks, you know, the platter shatters, or something like that, we can recover that data. So, that in mind. So let's say I want to write to sector 3. How is that going to work with this scheme? How many times am I going to actually write and read? Assuming, you know, I just get from the OS, hey, here's a new value for sector 3. What do I have to do to actually service that? Assuming I start with no information. Okay, someone have an answer for me? There?
So you can, I'm assuming like you have a new value of memory.
Okay.
You can read from sector 2.
Mm-hmm.
And then XOR the sector 2 with a new memory. And then write it to disk
Okay, so read V1. So we can write V1 XOR V2 to BP. So that's one write, and also write V2. So that's one read and two writes to handle this one write. So this is kind of the disadvantage of this scheme, but we have the ability to survive any disk just going away and not lose any data. And we can extend this scheme to use more disks. And this means that the penalty is not as bad as far as wasted space. And that's what's attractive about this, is that I can waste as little space as I want and still survive any one disk going away. So we'll pick up on this next time.